From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, performance poet Sapphire tells us about Precious Jones, the 16-year-old girl who's the narrator of Sapphire's new novel, Push. Precious is poor, barely literate, and is pregnant for the second time by her father. Sapphire says Precious is a composite of the students she taught in Harlem in the Bronx. Also today, memory tricks. Daniel Schachter is a memory researcher who is using brain imaging techniques to learn how the brain stores and retrieves information. He's the author of the new book, Searching for Memory. And music critic Milo Miles reviews a new 4-CD box set of music recorded in New Orleans from 1947 to 74. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton has scheduled a White House announcement this hour. He's expected to unveil new efforts to keep guns out of the hands of juveniles. The program features a federal computer database aimed at tracking and prosecuting gun dealers who sell weapons to kids. The program would expand an initiative underway in Boston, where police say gun-related deaths of young people are down. An empty school building has collapsed on St. Thomas. Tree branches are down on St. Croix, and rain is falling throughout the Virgin Islands, all thanks to Hurricane Bertha. The first hurricane of the Atlantic season is blowing across the northeastern Caribbean with winds topping 80 miles per hour. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
Hundreds of people in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are hunkered down in shelters as Bertha knocks down trees and floods streets. The eye of the hurricane is expected to hit St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, which was devastated by Hurricane Marilyn last year. The government of the Virgin Islands has declared a dusk till dawn curfew. Bertha is also expected to hit northeastern Puerto Rico, which was beaten up by two hurricanes last year. Many Puerto Ricans are scrambling to the more than 200 shelters that have been opened. A hurricane warning has been issued for the Dominican Republic, and a hurricane watch is in effect for the Bahamas. Forecasters say it's not clear yet whether Bertha will hit the U.S. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
The Senate opens debate today on a controversial bill to raise the minimum wage. But a GOP proposal to exclude small businesses already has earned the threat of a presidential veto. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
A long-delayed debate on a proposal to increase the minimum wage to $5.15 an hour from $4.25 an hour could come to a vote in the Senate on Tuesday. But conservative senators like Christopher Bond of Missouri say many small businesses could not survive the increased labor costs. They are proposing to change the wage bill so that it wouldn't apply to employees of businesses with less than $500,000 a year in gross receipts. In a letter to congressional leaders, Mr. Clinton called that change a poison pill, which would effectively exclude two-thirds of American businesses. Members of the House approved their version of a minimum wage increase back in May. On Wednesday, the two chambers will convene a special joint meeting to hear an address from Benjamin Netanyahu, the newly elected Prime Minister of Israel. I'm John Nielsen. In Washington.
A passenger who hijacked a Cuban plane to the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay yesterday is being questioned by U.S. authorities. Officials say the plane was on a flight from Santiago to Guantanamo when it was diverted to the naval base. The other passengers were released, but officials have not said whether the hijacker will be returned to Cuba. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down about 0.75 points at 55.88. This is NPR News. A man armed with a machete or an axe injured 6 children and a teacher at a school in England today. Details are sketchy, but police say the man apparently attacked the children and teacher inside the school in a town about 60 miles northwest of London. African presidents begin a 3-day summit today in the West African country of Cameroon. This year's meeting of the Organization for African Unity was supposed to focus on trade and economics. Instead, leaders will discuss the violence in Liberia and Burundi. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The Organization for African Unity, or OAU, is known more for talking than acting. The group's charter opposes interference in the affairs of its members. Still, the OAU is finding it hard to ignore the brutal civil wars in Africa. Children are scheduled to address the group, saying how war has shattered their lives. The African presidents will likely try to push Liberia's warlords into peace talks One draft resolution threatens to prosecute the Liberian leaders for war crimes if they don't make peace. Burundi's ethnic war is also high on the agenda. The OAU is expected to endorse the idea of sending an African peacekeeping force there, though plans for a force are now stalled due to opposition by groups in Burundi. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
Another church fire has been reported, this one in Washington State. A spokesman for the local sheriff says there's no doubt the fire was set deliberately. It was discovered early yesterday morning by the minister of the Pleasant Hill Missionary Baptist Church about 40 miles south of Seattle. It caused an estimated $80,000 in damage. Firefighters in Utah are hoping that cooler, wetter weather forecast for today will help them get an upper hand on wildfires, which have scorched nearly 35,000 acres. About a dozen fires are burning in west-central Utah, five of them major. About 1,500 firefighters are on the line trying to contain them. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the worst things that can happen to a young person in America happened to Clarice Precious Jones, the main character in the new novel Push. She's poor, uneducated, and at the age of 16, she's pregnant for the second time by her father. Her firstborn has Down syndrome. As the novel progresses, Precious gets expelled from school, but she finds her way into an alternative education program where she meets a dedicated teacher who helps her to read, write, and express herself. The author of Push is a performance poet who goes by the name Sapphire. She spent 8 years teaching reading and writing to teenagers and adults in Harlem and the Bronx. Her father was a military man and she grew up on army bases. Push is her first novel. Her poems are collected in the book American Dreams, which has just been reissued. Many of her poems relate to her identity as a bisexual. Here's a reading from the opening of her novel, Push.
I was left back when I was 12 because I had a baby for my father. That was in 1983. I was out of school for a year. This gonna be my second baby. My daughter got Down syndrome. She's retarded. I had got left back in the second grade, too, when I was 7, because I couldn't read and I still peed on myself. I should be in the 11th grade getting ready to go into the 12th grade so I can go on and graduate. But I'm not. I'm in the 9th grade. I got suspended from school because I'm pregnant, which I don't think is fair. I ain't did nothing. My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I don't know why I'm telling you that. Guess because I don't know how far I'm going to go with this story or whether it's even a story or why I'm talking. Whether I'm going to start from the beginning or right from here or 2 weeks from now. 2 weeks from now? Sure, you can do anything when you're talking or writing. It's not like living when you can only do what you're doing. Some people tell a story and it don't make no sense or be true, but I'm going to try to make sense and tell the truth. Else what's the use? Ain't enough lies and stuff out there already?
Sapphire, thanks for reading that. Who is sure. Precious based on?
Well, Precious is based on a composite of many young women that I taught while I was working as a literacy teacher for 7 years in Harlem and the Bronx. She is not a real person. She is a fictional character.
Did you have your students keep journals the way the teacher in Push has her students keep journals?
Yeah, I did. I did.
Well, if you have students keep a journal, then they're going to be telling you the things that happened in their life, and some of those things are going to be pretty tragic. Does
exactly.
it become your responsibility to help them get through those tragedies in their life once you get
yeah,
their
I
journals?
Yeah, I mean, all students do not use their journals as an emotional release. You know, so they you know, some students will tell you everything that ever happened to them, and other students will use it to, you know, recount the daily activities in the neighborhood or their hopes and dreams, or they'll write poetry and stuff like that. Everybody is different in how they keep a journal, you know. So the journal Precious first keeps is called a dialogue journal, where she speaks and then the teacher speaks back to her. And that is a whole another one way of teaching. And then there's, of course, the you know, literature journals where students keep a commentary on what they've read and stuff like that. But I think when you really enter into a dialogue journal, you have to set up criteria in the beginning. You know, so I never students talked to me about you know, gave me a lot of information. I tried to share myself with them also. I never had any. The only criteria I ever had, and I made it, you know, I would make it public that if sometimes they would get depressed, and if there was ever mention of suicide or, you know, self-destructive tendencies in the journal, I made it clear to them that I would, you know, intervene and try to get outside help. That in other words, I would break the confidentiality of the journal. Other than that, there was nothing. Even like some of the like, you know, if they would talk about incest or rape or you know, issues about HIV, I never would disclose those issues or mm-hmm. you know, intervene in any way unless I had their permission.
When you were teaching writing, did you want to teach standard English, or did you just hope that your students would be able to write, period? You know, and whatever they wrote was a mm-hmm. step forward.
Exactly. So we can see in the book with Precious that the very most important thing is to first to get writing. And then there's a lot of different processes you can use as a teacher to bring in issues around grammar and standard English, and also to really begin to respect the language that the students are using, and just to really acknowledge that when someone speaks and writes like Precious, she is speaking one language, and then to tell her that the language of power, the language that you'll need to get a job, is standard English. You can't take someone like Precious and start talking about verbs and adverbs and nouns. What would happen if that had been, if you had done that the first day? Imagine that scene in the book where Precious first picks up a pen and attempts to write. And suppose Miss Rain, instead of telling her just write what you're thinking, had told her, you know, make sure that this sentence is grammatically correct.
Did you think of it as a calling during the years that you were doing it, as a mission, I should say, as something profoundly important that you wanted to give to the students?
As far as a calling, teaching was the last thing I ever wanted to do. You know, I wanted to be a performer. I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be a dancer. I wanted to be a writer. So I felt very much mismatched in my profession that I found myself. In fact, sometimes when I was having trouble, I would wonder, well, where are the real teachers? You know, why are people like me here doing this? Why don't they have trained professionals with PhDs? These kids have so many problems. They need the very best of the educational profession, not you. not artists, not struggling artists who can't find a job. You know, that's not who they need. But sometimes you just rise to the situation and... No, I shouldn't have been there, but I was there. And so I just did the very best I could.
Did you confront often strange combinations of street smarts and ignorance?
Total, you know, savvy and intuitive and experiential understandings of how the system works. And then I would just encounter total... kind of ignorance about certain language things. I remember one kid just telling me once he had to go visit his friend who was in the hospital who was really down with poly. And I kept saying, down with poly? What is poly? What is poly? And he was talking about that person had an extreme case of, you know, like hay fever of allergies and had, you know, was pollen. You know, not that this is, you know, real ignorance, but that this knowledge had never been presented to them in a certain way. And so while it is kind of amusing if it's something like poly or Down syndrome, when you think of that type of ignorance about certain type of physiological and medical processes extrapolated to things like HIV, it becomes tragic. So I did see a real lack of information that I thought was dangerous, but I didn't see a lack of intelligence, and I didn't see a lack of the desire to acquire knowledge.
Now, as you said, you know, your students were very smart about some things and very ignorant about others. Did your students know that you were lesbian or bisexual, and what was their reaction if they did?
Some of them did. You know, like one time I was teaching in the Bronx, and I had actually done this. It was like something on cable or something. Someone had, you know, taped one of my performances in something, and it had shown the night before. And I guess, like, you know, like. I don't know. I guess she had cable TV. I didn't see it, you know, but she saw it, and she, you know, I walked in the lobby the next day, and she started screaming, "I saw you on TV! I saw you on TV!" And I knew what she had seen, so I knew that she knew that I was a bisexual, and it was, you know, I just dealt with it as best I could. And sometimes when I felt more comfortable with the class, I would, you know, because they would reveal so much of themselves to me, I would just feel it's unequal if I don't tell them who I am also. And other times I needed to protect myself because some of the students were very, very homophobic, and it wasn't appropriate. Whether it was appropriate or not, I didn't feel safe to come out. So that's information I choose when and where to give to people if they don't have it. And there would be times when I would withhold that information just because I didn't feel safe.
Your students had a lot of stereotypes?
A lot of stereotypes. Well, you can see where they... In the beginning, they're talking about so-and-so is a butcher and this type of thing. So they had a lot of stereotypes, yes.
My guest is Sapphire. Her new novel is called Push. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist and performance poet Sapphire. Sexual abuse is a thread through a lot of your writing. A lot of your poems are about incest, and the main character in Push is abused both by her father and her mother. And I'm wondering if there's an autobiographical element in all of
that. Well, I'm a survivor of incest myself, and so while Precious is not me in the book, I think that having been through that experience and having survived it, I was certainly sensitive to it and could listen to it when it came up, and I was very attuned to it. So when my students started to talk about it, I didn't go to la la land, I didn't go to denial land. I knew where they could go for help. I listened to them. I didn't, you know, suggest or implant anything in them. I only listened to what they told me, and I believed them. And I tried to give them everything that I could in terms of resources, in terms of literature, that could help them also become survivors as opposed to victims of this social disease.
How old were you when you were abused, and how long did it last?
I was very, very young. So most of my abuse, I would say, happened before I was 7 years old. So it's very different in some ways the multiple abuse that Precious suffers and continues to suffer up into almost, you know, her late adolescence, up to 16 years old. So for me, it was the process of being abused very young and then having total amnesia in your life, never working, never knowing what goes right or wrong, and, you know, dissociative disorders and a lot of problems. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I really started to tap into that the problem might be more than just being a woman in black in America, that there might have been some internal problems within my family that I needed to look at.
So this was like a recovered memory.
Yes, exactly.
And you trust it?
I didn't trust it. I would not have trusted it as deeply if my sister, in a separate part of the country, unbeknown to me, had not recovered memories also. So she corroborated my memories in a way that I think I would have just thought I was crazy if she hadn't remembered first, actually.
In a lot of your writing about incest, a lot of what you seem to be remembering is smell, the smell of an uninvited sexual partner.
Yeah, I think what happens, two things happen with children, is that part of how they survive is they have a heightened sense of smell and taste, you know, so that you know, they're little animals, and that's part of what nature gives them, so that, you know, they don't turn away from food and stuff like that. So the same odor that is a turn on to an adult is overwhelming to children. And so I would hear this over and over again in my I went to incest recovery groups where I would listen to other women's stories. And so I was not abused in the way that Precious was by her mother, but the women who had suffered abuse by other women, almost to the point of it would be disturbing for me, because, you know, I'm into women, you know, but over and over they would just talk about the, you know, the odor and the disgust that they felt, and also how we have to deal with how, to little children, how large our sexual organs are. You know, what's you know, we can deal with to children is absolutely overwhelming. And then I think the other thing that comes in is often the perpetrator sets you up in positions that where it's dark. You can't see. And often it's all done in silence, you know what I mean? So often memory is recovered by odor, you know what I mean? You'll be stimulated in that way, and it'll trigger a memory, and that'll bring in. And again, sometimes the memories will only be odor and feeling. So imagine if this happens totally in the dark. You never will be able to describe your perpetrator.
Now, after you left home, you went to New York. Mm-hmm. And I believe became a go-go dancer there for a strip dancer?
All of it. Go-go dancers are different from strip dancers, so I did both of them. I was very talented. I guess this was a joke. I'm only
playing. Well, it might have been. Fine.
No. But go-go is two different things.
Right. Yeah. But I'm wondering what it was like for you if you felt that you'd been abused at home to then.
Well, at the time I was doing that, I didn't have the. I didn't know I had been abused, you know, so I hadn't recovered any memories. And I don't know, they actually, statistically, actually, that's supposed to be a big common denominator in women who work in the sex industry, that they have suffered some type of abuse. But for me, it was like a lot of young women will tell you, it was liberating on some level. You know, I had money in my pocket, I was free, I was in situations usually where I was protected. And I felt I was doing better than if I was just somewhere, you know, cleaning somebody's house or shuffling papers and stuff. So, you know, it was not the actual worst thing I've ever experienced in my life. But it certainly was. Now that I look at it, I realize, oh, you know, you could have been in graduate school or something. But you don't really look at it that way then. You just need some money and you get into it. And I got a chance to see how on one level, interactions between men with money and power and women with no money and who are powerless work. And I'm grateful for what I learned in that experience.
Now, I don't know if at the time you thought of yourself more as a bisexual or a lesbian, but
I mean,
I'm wondering.
At the time I was go-go dancing.
Exactly. But I was wondering how you felt knowing that it was your job to arouse men.
I think when I was go-go dancing, the kind of not disgust, but some of the problems I had encountered in the men made me, I didn't feel like I was bisexual. I felt like I was totally a lesbian. It was interesting when I really went into the total militant lesbian stage. That was when I was involved in sex work, you know, so it was something about those non-nurturing and non-positive relationships with men made me feel like I never wanted to see another one again. So it wasn't even about being bisexual. I went into this total militant stance of almost separatism, you know, they're such, you know, slime buckets, let's get away from them and stuff like that. So it was a real paradox there.
Yeah,
it wasn't until I got out of sex work that I began to see myself as more bisexual than lesbian.
How did you start writing poetry and also performing it with a real emphasis on the performance aspect of it?
Mm-hmm. I started writing poetry when I was in San Francisco in the early 70s, and I was very, very influenced by the young poet and playwright then, Entezaki Shange. In fact, I think she just ripped open so many women's worlds and just showed us the possibilities of poetry and performance. And so I started out very much imitating some of what I had seen her do, but just I came up thinking that's how you do it. You know, you write the poem and then you get some drums and some dancers and you get out there and perform it. So that to me was something I was doing way, way before I thought about sending a poem to someone to get them to publish it. That was, you know, I mean, that wasn't even part of my consciousness. It was, poetry was meant to be performed. It was an oral art. It was something that you made eye contact with your listeners. You know, it was physical. It was visceral. It was alive. You put music to it. You put slides behind you. So that is what I, you know, I didn't know anything about the American Poetry Society or the 100 best poets of 1992 and all that kind of stuff. I thought of it as the way you jazz musicians and stuff think of their art, as something that you work hard, you perfect, but it's something you try to take to the people.
I'd like you to perform one of your poems for us.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to read the last section of the title poem in my book of prose and poetry, American Dreams, which actually is being released now with by Vintage Press. So it's a new edition of American Dreams, which was first published in 1994 by High Risk Serpent's Tail. And this is the last part of the poem American Dreams, and I'll just read it. One time, when I was a little girl living on an army base, I was in the gymnasium, and the general walked in. And the general is like God or the president, if you believe. The young woman who was supervising the group of children I was with said, "Stand up, everybody, the general's here." Everybody stood up except me. The woman looked at me and hissed, "Stand up for the general." I said, "My father's in the army, not me." And I remained seated. And throughout 38 years of bucking and winging, grinning and crawling, brown nosing and begging, there has been a quiet 10-year-old in me who has remained seated. She, perhaps, is the real American dream.
Is that something that really happened to you?
Yeah, it really did. You know, I was really brought up to, you know, it was in my household, but it was also in the culture. Like, you know, I was raised on army bases in the 60s and the 50s. And when these generals walked in, you stood up, you know, and there was, you know, the big crisis in my family came the day in, you know, fourth grade when I wouldn't do the Pledge of Allegiance. We thought we were going to get kicked off the army base. You know, it was just like I was putting my father and my family in jeopardy. So there was this real, you know, kowtowing to authority and a real taught to, you know, you have to understand this was when people just gave a command and you did it. And so it was really taught that we followed orders under all circumstances and that you don't question authority. But what I was saying then was, you know, this is, I separated from my father. Okay, that's his job. I'm not in the army. You know, I'm a kid, forget the general, you know.
How did you change your name to Sapphire? What name were you born with?
I was born with the name Ramona Lofton.
And what was behind the change?
Well, I didn't like Ramona that much. I just didn't like the sound of the name, although I like it more now. But I just wanted, it was in the 70s, I wanted a new age name. You know, like I said, I was out there and you had someone like Antozake Shange, who had been named Paulette Williams. You know, she had that beautiful name. And all my friends were naming themselves Crystal and Imani and Aisha and, you know, Opaline, Free Woman, stuff like that. And I wanted a nice, beautiful name, too. So I chose Sapphire as my new name.
How come you didn't choose a more African-sounding name?
Well, you know, I won't tell you what the name was, but Sapphire was actually a second name. I did have an African-sounding first name. So I had African-sounding name and then Sapphire as a last name. But people kept calling me Sapphire and kept not using the African name. And after a certain time, I started to feel awkward with the African name. And so I just dropped it and became Sapphire. So I did choose an African name at first.
And would you not want to say the name because it has too
no,
much power?
No, because it sounds, or? No, uh-oh. Because it really was like one of the worst African names you could have chosen. You know, I didn't choose a cool one, you know. So, and then when I really looked at it, I said, well, the cool name is Sapphire. That's the cool name, you know. And that's what I went with.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Sapphire's new novel, Push, is published by Knopf. Vintage has brought out a new edition of her collection of poems, American Dreams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, memory cues. We've all had the experience of a certain smell triggering a memory. We'll discuss how that happens with memory researcher Daniel Schachter. And music critic Milo Miles reviews a new collection of New Orleans rhythm and blues. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Daniel Schachter is a memory researcher who's using state-of-the-art imaging techniques to learn how the brain stores and retrieves memories. He's also learned about memory by studying amnesiacs, stroke victims, and others with memory disorders. Schachter co-founded the Unit for Memory Disorders at the University of Toronto. He's now a professor of psychology at Harvard. He's the author of the new book, Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past. I asked him if he could describe what happens in the brain when a memory is stored, if there's a physical change in the brain.
There is something physical. There are changes in the brain that reflect the memory, and many people believe that this is based on changes in the patterns of connections among neurons in the brain. But one fascinating insight that we've had in memory research over the last number of years is that there isn't any one place that the memory is stored. There's nowhere that you could go in and poke around and stimulate and say, aha, I found the memory, there it is, it's in that cell, or it's in that little group of cells. Rather, the view that many of us subscribe to is that different parts of the brain analyze different aspects of experience. Maybe there are parts of the brain devoted to analyzing visual experience, others to auditory experience, others that react to emotional aspects of experience. And these different parts of the brain seem to hold in their different respective areas the relevant attributes that relate to how they operate. So, for example, visual areas of the brain probably hold on to the visual aspects of an experience. Auditory areas of the brain probably hold on to the auditory aspects of experience. So the memory is kind of distributed among a wide set of brain structures that were involved in encoding the experience in the first place. And many people believe that these structures in the inner parts of the temporal lobes that I referred to earlier help tie together or hold together or link or bind these different areas that were involved in encoding the experience in the first place. So the memory is kind of all over the place to speak about it informally.
And now when we want to retrieve memories, is this why sometimes like a smell will bring back a flood of memories? Because the smell part not only gets a smell memory, but it triggers off the other interconnected parts of the larger memory?
Yeah, exactly. One of the interesting things about retrieval cues is that for them to work, they have to have been things that were salient when you initially encoded an experience. There are lots of experiments that show this. It's one of the fundamental principles of the psychology of memory that it's not just any old cue will do, but it's got to be a cue that reminds you of something you think or felt at the time of the original experience. I was on a visit to San Diego a couple of years ago with my family, and having been there many times, I wanted to do something novel. So we decided to go out to visit the Coronado Hotel, having never been there before. We drove out. My wife read a description of it to me. We got to the hotel, and it's a magnificent, beautiful example of Victorian architecture. We walked through the lobby and walked into a little courtyard, and all of a sudden I remembered, my God, I've stayed at this hotel. I was here for a conference 4 years ago. Why didn't I remember it until I walked right into that courtyard? Well, that was a trip that took place just before I made a move to Harvard University, where I'm now a professor. And I had kind of encoded that trip to myself as the trip before Harvard. And out in that courtyard, lots of people were asking me about how my move was going because I was about to move in a week and all the conversation centered around that. So that courtyard was kind of a cue that reinstated how I initially thought about that trip, whereas other features of the experience, like what the hotel looked like and so forth, were not as salient. So it's a fundamental point about retrieval cues is they've got to reinstate how you thought about or how you reacted to an experience in order to be effective.
People who drive with me won't want to hear this, but sometimes, like I'm on the expressway and I say to myself, gee, I don't remember entering the expressway, but here I am on it. That's a disturbing thought to have. But, often I'm like listening to a tape and, or I'm, deep into a song I'm listening to on a CD or a tape when I'm in the car. And this is a kind of scary thing when you don't remember how you got to where you are.
It is a scary thing, and I would have to admit that it's happened to me more than once in my life, and I'm sure it's happened to most of us. But it reflects something really important about memory, which is that, again, memory is not a video recorder just simply taking pictures of the world out there. And the kind of situation you're referring to is one in which we're wrapped up focusing on internal thoughts, preoccupations, and we're not paying attention to the external environment.
Is there a memory muscle that you can exercise and strengthen, thereby strengthening your ability to remember anything?
No. That, again, you've hit on one of the persisting myths of memory, and it turns up in a number of different guises. But let me give you a couple of examples that illustrate why I say no, and no pretty firmly on that one. A number of years ago, some psychologists at Carnegie Mellon University wanted to examine that kind of question. If you just brought someone into the lab and had them practice remembering information over and over again, would it be possible to strengthen the memory muscle so that they would just have a better memory for everything they encountered? Brought in a couple of college students, had them try to remember digit strings. People usually can only remember 7 digits from immediate presentation. Had them do lists of digits over and over again. After 2 weeks, there was little improvement in either of them. One of them quit. However, one student stayed with the practice, and after a couple more weeks, started recalling more than 7 digits at once. He got up to 20. He got up to 30. Several months of practice, he got up to 50, he got up to 70, he got up to 80. I mean, I give you a string of 80 random digits and you give it back to me in order. You might think, well, maybe the memory muscle did improve, it just took a lot of practice. But in fact, that's not what was going on. This student had hit upon an encoding strategy a couple of weeks into practice of bringing to bear his previous knowledge and memory on this current new information he had to remember. He was a track runner for the Carnegie Mellon track team, and he figured out a scheme for making that information available so he could make these digits meaningful. So if he saw a string like 4125, he'd think, oh, that would be a pretty good time for me running a mile on a windy day, and built from there some very elaborate strategies. So that at the time that he could use these strategies to remember 80 digits at once, when he was given a test for letters, he could still only remember 7. His memory muscle hadn't improved. He managed to find his way to this fundamental insight that memory for new information depends critically on using what you already got in memory.
Mm-hmm. So I guess your best advice on how to remember something is to focus on it. Don't be distracted and dividing your attention between this and something else at the same time. And also try to have some kind of meaningful associations.
It's the meaningful associations that are critical. Analyzing incoming information deeply. There's a study I quote in the book that I particularly like that looked at how actors memorize their lines. Mm-hmm. And you might think they do all kinds of brute force memorization and rack their brains, repeating lines over and over. Doesn't seem to be that way. What they do is they search for clues to their characters in the lines. So they're carefully analyzing everything their character says, and the result of that detailed, careful analysis is an excellent memory for exactly what the character said, because the subtle nuances of what the character said that the actor is analyzing then are retained in memory as a result of that kind of an encoding process. So to the extent that we can do that thoughtfully, extensively, and elaboratively, and now analyze the world around us, we will an automatic benefit will be good memory for that information.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's an expert on memory. He studied a lot of patients who have had brain dysfunctions and brain injuries. His new book is called Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with psychologist Daniel Schachter, author of the new book, Searching for Memory. Since memory is so subjective and also so unreliable, do you think most of us live in delusions about who we really are and what we've really done and lived through? I mean, if I told you the story of my life, would I probably be filling that story with distortions?
Yes and no. I think that distortion in memory, as I discuss in the book, tends to occur at the level of remembering particular experiences. There's a fascinating aspect of memory that we call source memory, remembering exactly when and where something occurred. And this is an important source of memory distortion. For example, one dramatic story I tell in the book is of a psychologist who was accused of rape on the basis of a very accurate eyewitness identification. It turned out, however, that he had an airtight alibi. He was on television talking, ironically, about memory at the moment when the woman who was raped was raped. And the reason he was accused is that under stress, the woman had remembered his face. She was watching this very show, but forgotten the context from which she derived this information. It wasn't the rapist. It was the television. So when the failures of source memory, remembering exactly when and where some bit of information came from, turn out to have enormous implications for understanding a memory distortion that I talk about in the book with respect to childhood testimony, brain damage, aging. However, when we talk about memory for the broad contours of our past, the general outlines of our past, the kinds of things that have happened to us repeatedly, I would say we're basically pretty good. Studies have shown, for example, that family members generally have the same kinds of memories at the general level, the general features of their childhood. So there's some distortion always around the edges, but the most serious kinds of distortions in memory usually occur at the level of individual episodes.
What are you looking at now in your research?
Doing a number of things. We're very excited about some recent work we've done on brain scanning, where we found that it's possible to distinguish between true and false memories using PET scans. And we found some interesting similarities between true and false memories using these PET scans. And this is some work that is described in the book when I talk about memory distortion. So we're following up on that. We're trying right now to get a good picture of what's going on in the brain during true and false memory. Because although psychologists have known about memory distortion for many years, it's only very recently now that people who are interested in the brain bases of memory have started to look at this important issue. So we're doing a lot of that.
Let me stop you there for a second. What is a false memory, and how can you tell with the research that you're doing? How does it register differently in the PET scan?
In the particular study I'm talking about, we induced a quote-unquote false memory by having people listen to a series of words that are all thematically related to one another. For example, I would say to you, candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, nice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, eat, pie. And what you will find is that if you test someone's memory a few minutes later after having heard those words, if I ask you, for example, did I say the word taste, do you remember?
I think so. Couldn't swear to it.
Couldn't swear to it, but you think so. How about the word point?
I don't think so.
You don't think so. How about the word sweet?
I think so.
Didn't say sweet.
Okay.
That's your false memory.
Right.
The reason why you thought so for sweet is that it's thematically related to all the words I did say, candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, and so on. And what psychologists have found initially a number of years ago, a psychologist named Dees found out that people who heard this list would often produce the word sweet, even though it was never produced. And a couple of colleagues of mine, Roddy Roediger and Kathleen McDermott, recently found that people will, like you just did, will false alarm to sweet and claim with great conviction that it was on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we looked at memory for words like sweet during PET scans that had been preceded by a bunch of associates, but had not been presented, which people felt that they remembered. And we compared that to PET scans, for example, for words such as taste, which had been previously presented. And what we found, one interesting similarity between the two, is that we found some signs of activity in the inner medial or medial regions of the temporal lobe that we know are important for memory, for both the true and the false memory. On the other hand, we found that there was a part of the brain in the left hemisphere that has been previously implicated in memory for sound or phonological properties of words that was active for the true memory, but not for the false memory, and significantly more so for the true than the false. So this is what allowed us to distinguish between the two. And I talk about some of this at length in the book, and we're now following up on this, and we think this is an interesting kind of first glimpse into some of the brain systems that are relevant to accurate and distorted memory. And in our research program now, we're investigating this. Because one of the things that fascinates me is what I call in the book, it's kind of the driving theme of the book, what I call the fragile power of memory. Why is it that memory can, as in this little example here, be distorted, sometimes ephemeral, yet at the same time it has such great power in our lives, and we can have great conviction sometimes about memories that are wrong. And what I'm really interested in doing is figuring out some of the brain basis of this fragile power of memory that I talk about in the book.
Boy, you know, somebody might want to do a very high-tech lie detector test based on the research that you're doing. How would you feel about that?
Well, you know, this question often comes up, and I don't think that this could be used in that way for a number of reasons. Number one, the particular brain area that we found that activated more for true than false memory probably would move around depending on exactly how you did the task.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in our PET experiment, people heard the words at the time of study, just like I read them to you. And that's why we think the auditory area activated more for true than false memory. My guess is you'd get a different area activated if people saw the words, for example, at the time of study. But so it's not that there's one area that would function as a lie detection area. Second, these PET scan experiments depend on a whole series of comparisons among experimental conditions. They're fairly complex, and it would be way overly simplistic to think you could hook someone up and just get a readout on whether the memory is true or false. This study doesn't say that we can do anything like that.
And what you were saying about whether the memory was more of a verbal memory or a taste memory, it would register in a different part of the brain. That gets back to what you were saying before about the different systems of memory that we have. It's not all in one place. It's not all one thing.
That's exactly right. And once you have that insight, then you start to think about memory in a very different way. You start to think about what experiments you're going to do in quite a different way. So rather than thinking that we had activated a true memory center or anything of that sort, we think that what happened is we got some activation for an aspect of memory that was relevant to the particular task, and now we want to try to see if we can move that around in future studies.
I have one last question for you. What's your favorite amnesia movie? It's a whole genre, the amnesia film.
That's right, and there are quite a few of them. I got to come down on the side of the old classic, Spellbound. I don't think it ever got any better than that.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Daniel Schachter is the author of the new book, Searching for Memory, published by Basic Books. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard. Coming up, New Orleans Rhythm and Blues. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of a new 4-CD set of New Orleans music called Crescent City Soul, The Sound of New Orleans. The collection spans the years 1947 to 1974.
When the annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival rolls around every spring, it's often accompanied by commemorative collections of New Orleans rhythm and blues and rock and roll. Most are slapdash affairs with the same overly familiar tunes. A surprising exception is the 4-CD set called Crescent City Soul, The Sound of New Orleans, 1947 to 1974. This includes heaping selections of the material that flourished in the middle 50s with Shirley and Lee, the Spiders, and Fats Domino, then rebounded for wider crossover in the early 60s with Ernie K. Doe, Chris Kenner, and Aaron Neville. The Crescent City Soul collection concentrates on the vaults of the Imperial and Minute labels, with some decent nods to Atlantic, Specialty, and other companies that recorded New Orleans musicians. The material's remarkably of a piece, no matter who put it out originally.
Now you take Sally, and I'll take Sue, and we're gonna rock away all our blues. Come on, come on.
Just what is the ageless appeal of New Orleans R&B? Any performer you ask identifies the tumbling piano triplets and the syncopated so-called second-line rhythm in the drums as key ingredients in the sound. There's a notable influence from Cuban rumba, by the way, and New Orleans beats were in turn a heavy stimulus to the precursors of reggae. New Orleans songs are sweeter, sexier than more purely blues-based R&B. The threats and snarls of the macho vocalists don't feel so much like a slap. Also, there's the wonderful argot of the Crescent City. Some of my favorite song titles include Giacomo, Ti-ta-ti-ta-ta, Sissy Strut, I'm Gonna Be a Wheel Someday, Who Drank My Beer While I Was in the Rear, and this rabid follow-up to Jesse Hill's Oopoopadoo, which is called Whip It On Me. The not-so-secret heroes of New Orleans R&B are a couple of producer-songwriter bandleaders, Dave Bartholomew, who dominated in the 50s, and Alan Toussaint, who played the role in the 60s. They produced huge hits like Fats Domino's Ain't That a Shame, as well as obscurities like Whip It On Me. Indeed, the only big gripe I have about the Crescent City Soul set is that too many famous hits are concentrated on the first disc. Spreading the wealth around would have made the other sides even more listenable. The little gripe I have is the same one I always have about anthologies of New Orleans music. They're so backward-looking.
Indeed, the whole town is too wrapped up in the past, and even new tunes sound quite conservative now. Alan Toussaint has a new label, Nino, with his first solo album in quite a while on it, called Connected. It's downright pleasant for old fans, full of gorgeous, inventive horn charts. But he's such a nice, compassionate guy here that the temperature never gets above tepid. Newcomers would be advised to seek out the reissue of his mid-career sides called just the Alan Toussaint Collection. A couple other New Orleans supplements seem in order. The first is a delightful reissue of guitarist-singer Snooks Eaglin's R&B sides with the very descriptive title, The Complete Imperial Recordings. Lots of catchy licks and lively Bartholomew production. Even better, find the expanded CD version of the album called The Wild Magnolias. This is the major style of New Orleans soul missed on the Crescent City collection, the zany polyrhythmic funk of the 70s. This stuff doesn't just sound timeless, it's even a little progressive. Imagine New Orleans with a tomorrow as well as a glorious yesterday.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. He reviewed Crescent City Soul on the EMI label. Alan Toussaint's new label has brought out a new CD by Wallace Johnson, a 58-year-old from Louisiana who'd given up singing professionally many years ago. He made a couple of 45s when he was younger, but this is his first album. We like it a lot, and we'll soon talk with Johnson on Fresh Air. So we'll close with music from his CD, Who's Thrilling You? Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Phoebe Vanskoy. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Someone else, I can tell by the way you carry yourself. But if you let me, here's what I'll do. I'll take care of you. I've been hurt the same as you, so you see I know just what you've been through. But if you let me,
oh, Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.